I am delighted now to welcome Daniel Schrag. He is a professor in the Laboratory for Geochemical Oceanography in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University. He is the recipient of the MacArthur Fellowship in 2000. He studies climate and climate change over the broadest range of the Earth's history. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
How far back in the history in the Earth's climate do we know about Earth's climate, and how do we know?
Well, it's interesting. I think we have information about the evolution of our planet from the very earliest times, from the formation of the planet 4.5 billion years ago. We actually don't have any rocks on the Earth that are that old, but we can actually look at our neighbors. We can look at what happened on Mars, and we can look at what happened on the Moon, and try to understand what the Earth might have experienced at those times.
Looking at moon rocks brought back from the astronauts, say, can tell you about the climate of the Earth?
Well, it tells you some things. One of the really obvious things that you can see just from any kind of binoculars looking at the moon is that it's full of craters. And the trips we made to the moon in the 70s through the Apollo missions told us that those craters, many of them are actually very, very old, basically between 4.5 and 3.8 billion years ago, a time we called the early bombardment period, when the Earth, like the Moon, must have experienced an incredible number of large impacts of meteors hitting the Earth, causing incredible disruption. And most scientists think that anything that happened early in that period would have been any kind of, if life had evolved during that period, it would have been quickly snuffed out because the impacts were so violent.
I thought that there were different impacts on the Earth and the Moon because of the Earth's atmosphere being so much thicker than the Moon's virtually non-existent atmosphere.
Well, for small meteorites, that's true. Small meteorites with the Earth's atmosphere, they burn up and they create shooting stars. But for larger impactors, the atmosphere isn't enough to make them burn up, and therefore they come right through and create large craters.
And so what does that tell us about climate?
Well, it tells us that the earliest part of Earth history, until about 3.8 billion years ago, was not a very happy place to be. After that, we have evidence on the Earth that there was liquid water. There were oceans. We have sedimentary rocks that formed in oceans. And it turns out that that's actually a very surprising story. The reason is that the sun, which is the source of heat for the Earth's climate, there is some addition from geothermal heat, but it's actually very, very small compared to the incoming solar radiation we receive every day. So the Earth's climate is controlled by the amount of sunlight we receive from the sun. And the sun, 4 billion years ago, was probably about 30% dimmer than it is today.
Is that right?
That's common of every star like the sun, that as the star evolves, more and more fusion takes place in its core, and it actually gets brighter and brighter as it ages. So the sun was very dim. So scientists were confused for a long time, because today, if the sun got 30% dimmer, our planet would be completely frozen. So the question was, how could there have been such an incredibly warm climate enough to have a liquid ocean when the sun was so dim? And the answer turns out to be a complex set of feedbacks between the atmosphere and the geology of our planet. That carbon dioxide, the main greenhouse gas, appears to have changed over Earth history so that it was very high early on when the sun was dim and has slowly gone down as the sun has gotten brighter, essentially compensating for the brightening of the sun and maintaining a habitable planet, kind of like a thermostat in your home.
So there was a much stronger greenhouse effect at that time because of the CO2 in the atmosphere.
That's right.
And where did it come from?
The CO2 actually came from inside the Earth. There's a huge amount of CO2 in the Earth, but today much of it is bound up in rocks and calcium carbonate, mostly in the shells of organisms like corals and clams and lots of other organisms that most people don't think about, but that are very important and fall on the bottom of the ocean floor. Now, it turns out that the key to this thermostat, the way this thermostat works for the planet, has to do with a chemical reaction. It's very slow, but it's very, very important. And what it does is it creates... It's a reaction between carbon dioxide and water, which makes carbonic acid, and that reacts with rock on the Earth's surface, and that reaction produces calcium carbonate. Essentially, it transforms carbon dioxide from a greenhouse gas in the atmosphere to chalk lying in the ocean floor. And that conversion turns out to be the secret. When the Earth gets too hot, that reaction speeds up. And so what happens is more CO2 from the atmosphere is converted to calcium carbonate, and the atmosphere and the greenhouse level drops a little bit. If the Earth gets too cold, what happens is that volcanoes are constantly emitting carbon dioxide from the interior of the Earth, and if the Earth gets too cold, those chemical reactions slow down, and volcanoes keep adding CO2, so the greenhouse gas level rises. And this is the thermostat that actually maintains the habitability of our planet over a really long time.
You're making the planet sound like a giant organism that has self-regulatory mechanisms.
You know, people who have proposed the Gaia hypothesis actually think about it this way. I think that's wrong. I think it's not life exactly. It's not an organism. But it does have feedbacks that regulate it and actually keep it in a habitable zone for most of Earth history.
But habitable is a word that refers to life, but it's not life forms that are doing this thermostatic activity.
That's exactly right. This could have happened had there never been life on this planet. The reason is that this chemical reaction between carbon dioxide, water, and rock requires liquid water. If it's too cold for liquid water, the reaction stops. And if it's too hot, then the reaction speeds up. We can actually look at our neighboring planets and actually see some analogies. Venus is very, very hot. It has an atmosphere about 100 times thicker than the Earth's, and it's composed almost entirely of carbon dioxide. So it's an ultra-greenhouse atmosphere. What most people don't realize is that its surface temperature of 460 degrees is not because it's closer to the sun, but really because of its greenhouse atmosphere. Venus, you say, well, why doesn't Venus have the same control? What Venus is missing is liquid water. Venus has carbon dioxide, it has plenty of rock, but it doesn't have any water, and so it can't have this chemical reaction. Mars, on the other hand, has water. It's got ice sheets that are liquid water, that underneath are probably have some liquid water. And it has a little bit of carbon dioxide. What it doesn't have is the internal heat. It's a much smaller planet, and it doesn't have volcanoes that are constantly putting CO2 back in the atmosphere. And so that's where Mars's planetary thermostat failed. So Mars was too cold, Venus is too hot, and we're just right.
And at what time in that big geological picture did life form?
Well, there's a big debate about that. Some people think life evolved right after this early bombardment period. As soon as the Earth was habitable for life to form, life did form, around 3.8 billion years. And there's some evidence to support that. Other people think that it may have actually taken quite a bit longer, maybe not until 3.3 billion years. Now, it sounds pretty trivial, the difference between 3.8 and 3.3, but it's actually a very interesting debate, because the people who think it occurred earlier would say that essentially life was inevitable, that any planet that is habitable for life would have life because life ultimately formed so quickly. If, on the other hand, it took another 500 million years for life to form, then maybe it was sort of a one-off event, and maybe it wasn't so obvious that it isn't so obvious that if there was another planet that had the same conditions, that life would also form on that planet. And that's really what this debate is about.
And it gets into sort of theological dimensions very quickly.
You could see that, yeah, although we like to keep it on the scientific plane.
We're talking to Daniel Schrag, who's going to be speaking tonight, tomorrow, and the next night at the James A. Little Theater at 7:30 in a series of lectures on climate. So you study, I mean, we can go back, a few hundred million years when we look at things like polar ice cores?
Actually, the ice cores only go back a few hundred thousand years.
The oldest one we have goes
back about 650,000 years. And so it's actually an important context. One of the things you learn when you study Earth history is that climate changes on all different timescales. So one response might be, well, so the climate's changing all the time. What's the big deal about the change we're experiencing now? From a planetary perspective, that's sort of true. From a human perspective, there's a lot to be concerned about. The ice cores show us directly that CO2, the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere, has never been higher than about 300 parts per million for the last 650,000 years. Now, indirectly, from ocean sediments, we can actually measure the chemistry of the shells of organisms that died millions of years ago and reconstruct things like ocean pH. And that tells us something about the carbon dioxide level also, because carbon dioxide is an acid and affects the ocean pH. And what that tells us is that probably CO2 levels haven't been much higher than they are today for 30 or 40 million years. Now, today, atmospheric CO2 is above 380 parts per million. And in the next 50 years, it's going to be above 500 parts per million. And the question that's confronting us right now is, are we going to stop there, or are we going to head all the way to 1,000 parts per million? And to me, that's really the challenge. But Earth history really frames this question. It says, look, we're doing an experiment. We're doing an uncontrolled experiment on the whole planet that hasn't been done for 40 million years. No scientist understands this system perfectly. There are going to be surprises.
And probably very unhappy surprises from a human point of view.
Well, there might be some happy surprises. There might be some things about the Earth that make it more robust that are better than what we expect. On the other hand, there are almost certainly going to be some things that are going to be worse than we expect. And we can actually look at the record of Earth history, of climate change throughout Earth history, and try to gauge how sensitive the Earth is to climate effects and how sensitive it is to changes in CO2. Unfortunately, most of the lessons suggest that the models that we use to predict the future, those are based on really just the last 100 years of observations. Very limited range of climate. If we look at a longer time scale and look at a longer range of climate, in general, the Earth appears to be much more sensitive than the models. And that means that climate change may indeed be much more severe than we think.
When we look back at the last, you tell me the time scale, but when we look back at great climate changes in the Earth's history, when did we have ice ages and why? When did we have periods of great heat with very little ice and why?
Well, that's a very good question. We actually are in an ice age today. Many people don't think about it that way, but we actually are in an ice age today because we have an ice sheet on Antarctica and we have an ice sheet on Greenland. 50 million years ago, a time period called the Eocene, was a time when there was no ice on any continent. It was so warm. There were crocodiles living up in the Arctic Circle, above the Arctic Circle. There were palm trees living in Wyoming. It was a very different world.
Did they find crocodile remains in the Arctic Circle?
They find crocodile remains up in Ellesmere Island, well above the Arctic Circle.
Amazing.
It was a very different world. Now, at that time, sea level was about 300 feet higher than today, because there was no ice anywhere on any continents. All the ice was melted.
How many feet higher?
About 300 feet higher. It was a very different world. That we can think of as a greenhouse world. And today we're living in a world with ice. It's not the maximum ice. That was 20,000 years ago was the most recent one we call the last glacial maximum, that some people call the last ice age. But we're still in an ice age today. That was just the last glacial maximum. At that time, ice covered a big part of North America, and sea level was about 130 meters lower, 400 feet lower than today, because there was so much water stored on the continents in ice sheets. Now, why do we have these warm periods, and why are there these cold periods in climate? It actually probably has to do with the same cycling of calcium carbonate through the system that we've talked about earlier, that there appears to be times, and I'm going to talk about this tomorrow night, that there appears to be times when the Earth, when carbon dioxide comes out of volcanoes more rapidly, and this has to do with changes in plate tectonics over very long timescales, over millions of years. And then times like today, when in fact there's actually relatively little carbon dioxide coming out of volcanoes, and we're in a relatively cold planet. Now, in both cases, there's a liquid ocean, the Earth is habitable, but they're very, very different states. An ice-free world versus a world with ice.
The time that we're living in, when we look at timescales like that, it's a tiny blip in geological history, but it's one which makes life not only makes the planet not only habitable for life, but habitable for human civilizations of the kind we've built. How much flexibility is there for human habitation?
Well, I think the key thing to understanding the impact on humans is the time scale. The Eocene climate 50 million years ago, when there were crocodiles up in the Arctic Circle, that was a time when, in fact, human civilization might have flourished as well. I don't think there's anything magical about our current climate, except that it's been relatively stable, and therefore we've adapted to it. Similarly, palm trees in Wyoming sound pretty nice. I'm sure we'd all live in different places if the climate were very, very different. If it was very warm, people would probably move away from the tropics and move towards the poles, and we'd have different ways of living. We would have adapted. The problem is the adaptation, both of humans and of natural ecosystems, occurs over thousands of years, sometimes tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. What we're doing to the planet today is changing the climate so rapidly in 100 years or less that many of those natural ecosystems and many human systems don't have time or will not have time to adapt. And that's where we get into trouble.
Added to that, there's a whole lot of us.
That's right. It's true that we have a lot of people, and that's part of the issue. The other part is that we have a lot of people in places where economies are rapidly growing and people are wanting more energy to watch television and drive their cars, and that's compounding the problem.
We're talking to Daniel Schrag. Let's talk about the current situation that we're in. How much has the climate changed so far? How much has the climate warmed so far? And how do you measure that? Do you measure the ocean? Do you measure the temperature of the air? Do you measure the temperature of the earth? Where? What parts of the world?
Well, scientists measure all of those things. They measure things everywhere. And in fact, the recent change over the last 100 years or so has actually been relatively small. It's only been a little more than a degree Celsius.
Which by some measures is a great deal when you think of the fragility of certain ecosystems.
Well, one of the problems is that people don't think very well about average climate, especially global average climate. They think about what the world, you know, what they experience local to them. And so if you're here in the Santa Fe Desert, you can get easily 60 or 70 degrees of change in a single day. It gets very cold at night and gets very hot during the day. And that's typical. So what's the big deal about a degree or two? Well, it turns out that it is a big deal. And I think a good way to calibrate people is to think about the last glacial maximum 20,000 years ago when an ice sheet covered most of North America. You know, the ice sheets came all the way down to New York City. Boston, where I live, was covered in a mile of ice. Very different world. The difference between that climate and this climate is about 5 degrees Celsius. And so what we're talking about is going 5 degrees Celsius over this century in the other direction. And I think that's a good way of thinking about the magnitude of what we're talking about.
How is it that a 5 degree Celsius difference, I mean, Boston is 90 degrees in the summer and it's cold in the winter. How would lowering the temperature 5 degrees make there be ice everywhere?
Well, when you change the global average climate by 5 degrees, what happens is you start snowing more in certain places, then ice sheets grow, and it turns out ice sheets have an amplifying effect on the climate. So as you start growing an ice sheet, the white surface of the ice sheet reflects more light back to space, and so it actually makes the Earth colder, and that amplifies itself. It's a positive feedback so that, in fact, the ice starts to spread more and more and more. Now, same thing is happening today. As we see ice melting, especially in the Arctic Ocean, the retreat of the Arctic ice replaces that sea ice with dark ocean water, which absorbs more sunlight in the summertime and actually amplifies the warming. So we're seeing a very amplified effect in the Arctic, and indeed, the Arctic temperatures have risen about twice as much as the global average.
Well, that's something I wanted to ask you. Because the Earth is so variable in the way that you're saying, where have we seen the most change in temperature and where have we seen the least?
Well, by far the most changes in the Arctic. And you know, if you live in Alaska, you certainly are aware of this. You can actually go up and visit Alaska and see dramatic changes in glaciers, and people have experienced huge changes in climate up above the Arctic Circle.
What about below the Antarctic Circle?
Well, the Antarctica is the opposite. Antarctica is the place where we've seen the least change, and that's because Antarctica is a huge ice sheet that, even though it's very slowly melting, really, it's so large that you don't even notice the change. And it's certainly its aerial extent hasn't changed. It may be getting slightly smaller, but it's still, the continent is still covered with ice. Unlike sea ice in the Arctic, which is getting thinner, this is a big land glacier over the entire Antarctic continent, and it really hasn't changed its overall area at all. And that means that it creates its own little microclimate, and as a result, Antarctica has really not changed in temperature much at all.
And the penguins are okay?
Penguins are okay for now.
But the Arctic is another story, and of course what we hear about most, probably for PR cuteness reasons, is about the polar bears.
Yeah, there's no question that in certain cases, you know, certain types of ecosystems have an opportunity to migrate in response to climate change, as long as it's slow enough to allow them to do it. So if the climate warms up a lot, creatures that are living, you know, at lower elevations can move to slightly higher elevations. Creatures that are living in lower latitudes can move to higher latitudes, and that way they will change their range. We're seeing that already in terms of tree species essentially establishing new areas and growing in places they didn't already. Unfortunately, there are going to be some losers, and the ones that are most adapted to the really cold environments, which are not just moving, but they're just disappearing, that's tough. And polar bears, unfortunately, may be stuck at this end of the spectrum.
We're talking to Daniel Schrag, who is a professor in the Laboratory of Geochemical Oceanography at Harvard, and we're talking about climate change in its multiform and myriad manifestations. One thing that I think is very important to talk about, when you have the ice sheets melting, you have this positive feedback. You also have something called the permafrost, which is, tell us about what the permafrost is and what happens when it starts melting.
Well, the worry we have about the permafrost has to do with the carbon cycle. Now, most of the increase in CO2 that we've seen over the last couple hundred years since the Industrial Revolution is due to burning fossil fuels, burning coal, oil, and gas. A little bit is due to deforestation and changes in natural ecosystems and our human land use, but most of it is just due to burning fossil fuel. Essentially, plant remains that have been in the earth for millions of years and have formed coal or oil or gas, and now we're using them as a source of energy. One of the things that worries many scientists, though, is that there's a lot of carbon stored in other places, and one of the big places where there's a lot of carbon stored is the permafrost. In the Arctic, some in Canada, but mostly in Siberia, there's a huge amount of organic carbon. And the reason for this is that mostly around here, soils have very, very little organic carbon. The reason is that they're warm, and there's oxygen, and therefore, and just a little bit of moisture, and that's enough for bacteria to live and essentially eat that organic carbon, the plant remains, and animal remains, and ultimately turn it back into carbon dioxide. And that's happening all the time in soils. In the permafrost, it's frozen, and so those bacteria don't exist. Now, over Canada, we had a big ice sheet 20,000 years ago covering that whole area. It kind of got scraped clean. So the soils in Canada and northern part of North America are actually very thin. So the permafrost there doesn't have a huge amount of organic carbon stored there. But if you go to Siberia, Siberia was a big continent, part of a big continent which didn't have an ice sheet because it was so big that there was no moisture supply for the ice sheet to grow. So as a result, Siberia has millions of years of organic carbon accumulating in its soils, and it's now frozen. The worry is that as the permafrost starts to melt, those bacteria will come alive and will essentially start eating that organic carbon, respiring it, and turning it back into CO2. Now, to put that in perspective, we're putting about 7 billion tons of carbon into the air every year from burning fossil fuel. There is about 500 billion tons of carbon stored in the permafrost in Siberia.
So driving a Prius just isn't going to make a dent on that.
Well, 500 billion tons, if it came out over 1,000 years, would only be 500 million tons a year. A lot, but, you know, a small fraction compared to how much fossil fuel we're burning. The worry is that we just don't know how long it'll take for that organic carbon to come out. And suppose it came out over 100 years. That would be 5 billion tons a year. That's almost as much as we're burning in fossil fuel. We would essentially lose control. The Earth would essentially have a positive feedback, and the CO2 level in the atmosphere would climb because we've sort of pushed it past a tipping point, past a threshold, and we really would have lost control of the system.
There's also the question of methane.
Well, methane is another important greenhouse gas. It's much more powerful a greenhouse gas than CO2. It's about 20 times as effective as a greenhouse gas, but it doesn't last very long. It oxidizes relatively quickly in the atmosphere. It's really gone in 7 to 10 years. So as a result, its level is much, much lower in the atmosphere, and it's not as important as carbon dioxide. With the permafrost melting, some of that organic carbon would be, instead of coming out of CO2, would be converted to methane and come out that way. And would have a big greenhouse effect, but then it would get oxidized to CO2. And ultimately, its effect would be as carbon dioxide.
I was talking to a scientist once who said also that if the permafrost melts and any of that area in the Siberian tundra catches on fire, we're really in trouble.
Well, that would be a way to get a lot of that organic carbon out very quickly. Similar concern is actually over the rainforest. The rainforest has a huge supply of organic carbon stored in living biomass. And one of the concerns is that the rainforest could get drier, and ultimately you could have a catastrophic fire in large parts of the tropics that would ultimately very rapidly take a lot of that organic carbon and put it back into the atmosphere. And that would be a big problem.
So you have, in your work, made distinctions between climate change and catastrophic climate change. Obviously, you can't predict what's going to be the tipping point and when in any precise way, but, you know, what brings us into the catastrophe?
Well, you know, Mary Charlotte, it's really not fun to be Cassandra. It's really not fun to be predicting a future of destruction.
Particularly since the myth of Cassandra is that she predicted the future and nobody listened to her.
Well, and I got to say, being a climate scientist for the last 15 years, it's felt a little bit like Cassandra, where you're predicting these things and nobody wants to listen.
Right.
On the other hand, the reason that you focus on the bad things is because ultimately making decisions about what to do about climate change involve risk. And, you know, when you take insurance policy on your house, you don't really take an insurance policy on your house because you might break a window. You take insurance policy out on your house because it might burn down. Similarly, as a climate scientist, focusing on some of the milder things is just less interesting and less important in trying to make a decision about what we should do about this problem than focusing on some of the things that are really consequential. Now, in terms of catastrophes, there are a number of things, and I think catastrophes really depend on your own perspective. Here in New Mexico, most people probably aren't very worried about sea level rise, although from a global economy perspective, sea level rise is really important because most of the world lives very close to sea level. In the U.S., for example, even just a mild change in sea level could be disastrous for the Gulf Coast, for big parts of Florida, for cities up and down the East and West Coast. So sea level is a very big deal.
The rise in sea level is caused also by a number of things, not just one thing. I mean, you have a situation where when you have climate change, the temperature of the ocean rises and the warmer things take up more space.
That's right. So the predictions of climate change, of sea level rise over the next 100 years, are really dominated by the thermal effects of a warmer ocean. So as the ocean warms, the water expands, and we think sea level is going to rise maybe 30 or 40 centimeters over this next century just because the oceans are warming.
That's 1 foot.
That's about a foot, right.
What about the melting of glaciers? Does that play a role?
So the melting of glaciers is really what has people worried. And that's, again, where there's huge uncertainty. Again, we're doing this experiment on the planet. We've seen glaciers melt before. During the last glacial maximum, 20,000 years ago, as those glaciers receded between then and now, at times the ice melted very rapidly and sea level rose very, very quickly, as much as perhaps a foot a decade. But the question is, we've never experienced something like this, where we're actually going from a relatively mild climate to a much warmer climate, where what happens to the ice sheets and how fast? I think if 10 years ago, if you'd asked the world's best glaciologists to predict how long it would take to melt Greenland, they would have said, 1,000 years or longer. And when I ask some of my friends now who work in this field, they say, they shrug their shoulders. They don't want to even guess. One of the things we've seen in the last 10 years is astounding observations of melting in Greenland that nobody expected to see in their lifetimes. So what we're watching is really extraordinary change. We still don't know. How long will it take to melt Greenland? Could it be 1,000 years? Yes. Could it be 100 years? It's unlikely, but it's possible. And what has, I think, many of us worried is that we really don't know, and we're sort of, it's not really fair to say we're playing with fire. We're playing with ice here. Maybe many people don't understand. We're talking about 7 meters of sea level rise if Greenland collapses. 7 meters or 23 feet. That's huge. In Antarctica, the small part of Antarctica, West Antarctica, we think is vulnerable, and that's about 6 meters of sea level change. And the big part of Antarctica, we hope, is going to stay there for a very long time. That's about 50 meters of sea level change.
And that means the entire coast of the United States is gone.
Well, at some point, that just becomes so catastrophic that we just can't afford it. That's why, you know, there has been a debate among some people in terms of what to do about climate change. Some people have said, you know, let's not try to stop it. Let's just try to adapt to it. Let's put all our money into trying to move people to higher ground and building seawalls. And they've looked at some of the predictions, and scientists are actually very conservative. And so the predictions for sea level rise over this century are about half a meter, 40 centimeters from warming of the oceans, and only 10 centimeters from melting ice. And that's because scientists don't want to say something that they're not sure of. And we really don't understand glaciers well enough to make a solid prediction of what's going to happen. So what we do is we look at the rate at which they're melting today, and we just project that into the future. But that's a very dangerous thing to do. So people look at that and they say 50 centimeters of sea level rise over a century, that's not a big deal. We can build a seawall. We can protect our cities easily. We don't need to actually stop climate change. We just need to protect our cities. But of course, that's silly, because after the first 50 centimeters comes the next meter, and then the next 3 meters.
And the positive feedback loop of the oceans being blue instead of white ice, and the whole thing accelerates.
That's right. One of the things that worries many of us is that there are these tipping points. There's points where there's a huge amount of inertia in the system. Once you start melting a glacier, it's not clear that you can reverse the system. So carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for more than 100 years, and in the ocean atmosphere system for hundreds of years. The ice sheets have very long timescales of evolution. So once you start to melt them, they may keep going for quite a long time. And similarly, the energy infrastructure we build, coal plants can last for up to 100 years. So the inertia in the system means that you can't just wait till something bad happens, because by then it's too late. There's already so much momentum that it's hard to stop it.
And it is sort of human nature to wait until something happens before you fix it.
That's right. You know, it's very, very unusual to actually do something a colleague of mine calls acting in time. There are very few examples where we actually take action before something bad happens. Very few examples where we actually did something dramatic to stop something that hadn't already sort of appeared.
So let's spend the rest of the show, which is only about another 15 minutes, talking about what is to be done. What are you working on?
Well, if you actually look at the whole carbon cycle and say, okay, how are we going to stop this? How are we going to fix the problem? The first answer you have to come to grips with is, we're not going to fix it. So some climate change has already happened. And in fact, even if we were to stop emitting CO2 tomorrow, which is, of course, impossible, our world depends on fossil fuel. 85% of our energy comes from fossil fuel. We're not going to go without tomorrow. But even if we were able to do that, the Earth would actually keep warming for decades because of the inertia in the system. So we have to realize that we are going to have dramatic climate change over the century. The question is, how bad will it get? And so we are going to have to adapt. We're going to have to do a lot of things to protect ourselves from climate change. But at the same time, we're going to have to stop the CO2 rise, because otherwise it may get unmanageable. Now, in terms of reducing CO2 emissions, well, our economy depends on fossil fuel. So what do we do? There are really only three choices. And one of those is using less energy. That can either be done through conservation, essentially trying to reduce the energy we use by doing less, or it can be done through efficiency, which means essentially doing smarter things, not wasting so much energy. It doesn't necessarily mean having a lesser quality lifestyle. We can do all the things we do today. We can just use less energy and be smarter about it.
So we're not sitting in the dark and eating organic carrots.
Exactly. I think that's the wrong image. I think some parts of the environmental movement have kind of pushed that idea of anti-growth. I think that's a big mistake. We want to have a prosperous economy. We want to live a really good way of lifestyle. And frankly, the Chinese do, and the Indians do as well, and many other people around the world. The question is, can they do that and still use energy more efficiently? The answer is yes. In this country, we waste a lot of energy. And so there's certainly a lot of ways where we can just be smarter about the way we use energy. That's the first part. The second part is using forms of energy that don't produce carbon dioxide. And there's really two classes here. There's renewable energy, wind, solar, geothermal, another number of other sources, and then nuclear energy, which is much more controversial. Here in New Mexico, it's a slightly more popular subject, given the proximity to Los Alamos. But
also the amount of nuclear energy you would need. I mean, I was reading, I think it was Daniel Nocera's calculations on this. You'd have to build a nuclear power plant every other day for the next 47 years to get the world's power you needed.
Well, that's one of the points, that none of these solutions, energy efficiency, nuclear power, solar, wind, there is no silver bullet. It's like what we like to call silver buckshot. There is no single solution. The rate at which you could produce nuclear plants is far too low to actually solve the problem. But there are many things that can make dents in the problem. So nuclear is a part of that. Solar is a part of that. Wind is a part of that. Everything has its role. There are limitations to all of them. In the case of nuclear, there's concerns about waste. There are concerns about safety. There's concerns about proliferation. In the case of solar, it's very expensive. And in the case of both wind and solar, they're not reliable. We have to figure out ways of storing the energy and building excess capacity, because you can't always count on the sun to shine. You know, cloudy day can't just sort of shut down a city. The third category, beyond energy supplies that don't produce carbon dioxide, is actually the responsible use of fossil fuel without emitting CO2. And that's something we call carbon capture and storage, or carbon sequestration. Turns out we've been actually doing this for a while in a very different way. About 30 or 40 years ago, the oil companies realized that they could actually get oil out of very old oil fields by injecting carbon dioxide into those fields and pushing more oil out. And they've been doing that for a long time. Well, what we're talking about doing now is taking like a big coal plant and capturing the carbon dioxide from the smokestack, separating it from the nitrogen, which makes up most of the flue gas, and then injecting that CO2 into a geologic reservoir where it will stay for thousands of years and remain separated from the atmosphere. Now, this makes some people nervous because they worry about leakage and they worry about all sorts of unintended consequences. It turns out that it's probably pretty safe, and it's something that's going to be necessary. If you look at how much fossil fuel we use, if you look at how much coal we use in particular, here in the U.S., in China, in Russia, in India, it's impossible to meet the energy needs of these countries without using coal, and therefore we have to develop this technology to use coal responsibly without putting CO2 in the air.
We're talking to scientist and Professor Daniel Schrag. What about the natural solution of using forests, which are natural carbon dioxide eaters, or imitating photosynthesis to take carbon mechanically somehow, which I know you guys haven't invented yet, but to take CO2 out of the atmosphere and convert it into oxygen?
Well, so planting forests actually is happening in many places around the world already. If you remember from your days in New England, you go for walks in the woods. In the middle of the woods, you find these stone walls in New England. Those stone walls weren't there when there was a forest. Those stone walls were built when there was pastures. 100 years ago, there were no forests in New England. It was all pasture land. And the forest has regrown, essentially. So all over New England, we're seeing huge reforestation, and indeed in many parts of the Midwest as well. And that is actually taking up quite a lot of carbon. It's a natural process from the fact that we deforested 100 years ago.
Right.
So there are opportunities for reforestation around the world, and this may be one of many strategies for reducing CO2 levels. If we did this really efficiently all over the world, reforestation might be effective at taking up something like 1 billion tons of carbon out of the atmosphere every year. Remember, we're putting in 7 billion tons a year. So 1 billion tons is a big number, but it's not that big. It's not really a solution, especially because that amount of CO2 we're going to put in the atmosphere, it's going to grow from 7 billion tons of carbon probably to 25 billion tons by the end of the century, with the rapid growth of China and India. So 1 billion tons is nothing to scoff at, but it's not nearly big enough to be a solution. Now, as far as artificial means of sucking CO2 out of the air, my group has actually been working on a way of doing this, and a number of other people have as well. It's all very, very expensive relative to actually taking it from a point source like a coal plant. So long before you would try to suck it out of the air, you'd actually try to suck it out of a coal plant and then stick it underground. It's just much cheaper and much more economical to do so.
There's a huge political dimension to this. I was listening to Democracy Now! The other day, and Amy Goodman was talking about having bumped into Robert Kennedy on an airplane and asked him what he thought the solutions were for climate change. And he said, taking on the problem of media consolidation and campaign finance reform.
Well, it's interesting. I've been on panels with Al Gore and Bobby Kennedy together. Unfortunately, in this country, this issue has become highly politicized. And unfortunately, it's become a partisan issue. So the Democrats are supporting doing something about climate change, and the Republicans, at least in the Senate, seem to want to say that climate change is not a problem or we shouldn't even believe that it exists. This is really sad, I think. I think it's part of a general problem we face in political issues and political life in this country. It's not true in other parts of the world. So if you look at Europe, for example, in Germany, Angela Merkel is she's a conservative leader, and she's very concerned about climate change. Or in the UK, Tony Blair was outspokenly supportive of doing something about climate change, and the opposition, the Tories, were just as supportive of this. They disagreed with Tony Blair on almost everything else, but not on this issue. And so, unfortunately, in this issue, it's become a partisan issue, and that has to change. And I think there's good news that many of the strongest supporters in the Senate are in fact Republicans. Not very many of them, but a few of them. For example, John McCain is very outspoken on his support for acting responsibly on climate change. And I think we will see more changes to that effect, I hope. This has to be a bipartisan issue. The reason is solutions are going to take 50 years. There's going to be changes in administrations, changes in who controls Congress, and whatever we do has to be able to outlive those sorts of political changes in this country.
We're talking to Daniel Schrag. The United States has not implemented the Kyoto Protocols. Tell us very briefly what the Kyoto Protocols are, and if every country in the whole world actually implemented them, how much good would it do?
Well, so the Kyoto Protocol was an agreement that we signed and many other countries signed that we negotiated in 1997 during the Clinton administration. Al Gore was very important in getting that deal together. Now, there are many people who think it's wasn't a very good treaty. I agree that it had many, many flaws. However, a problem of criticizing an international treaty is that any international treaty is a compromise, and therefore it's never going to be a perfect solution. We have to sort of accept that. That being said, there were a number of problems, but to me it was a small first step. The most important role of the Kyoto Treaty was to actually take a first step towards reducing emissions with the idea that it would only be effective if it was then added to later on down the road. So asking what the Kyoto Protocol would have done by itself is not the right question. It's looking at it as a first step towards future reductions and a process of getting more countries involved. Now, one of the concerns that the Kyoto Treaty was criticized about was not getting the developing countries on board, not getting China and India in particular to actually reduce emissions and requiring them to. That was a strong position that the U.S. Senate took at the time. I think that is a complicated issue. China looks at us and says, you know, you burn, you know, five times as much fossil fuel per person as we do. And you've created this problem for the last 100 years. We've barely contributed to it. And now you're telling us that we can't have our economic growth because of this problem of climate change. Well, we're concerned about climate change, they say, but we want to see you do something first. To me, that's actually an entirely reasonable position. So the question is, how could you negotiate something that actually engages the Chinese and the Indians in an effective path where we lead but they soon follow thereafter? I think that's possible today. I think arguing about whether the Kyoto Protocol was a good or bad at this stage, you know, the time for these commitments was going to end in 2010 or 2012. We're almost there. So, you know, 10 years after the negotiation, it's a little silly to argue about whether it was good or bad. What we need to figure out is what to do now. So let's move on. Let's actually move forward. And to me, the good news is that, in fact, you don't need all the countries that signed on to Kyoto to actually fix this problem. This is an international problem, which makes it much more difficult than just fixing our own behavior. But at the same time, there are only about maybe a dozen countries that really matter. If you got the U.S., China, India, Russia, the European Union, Australia, Japan, a handful of other countries, maybe Brazil and Indonesia, together in a room, you could actually go a long way to solving this problem.
And we're talking to Daniel Schrag. So we've just got a minute left. You will be speaking tonight about the history of the Earth's climate as far back as we know.
That's right. So tonight I'm going to talk about the long time scale of planetary evolution of climate. Tomorrow I'll be talking about climate change in the human dimension. And then finally on Thursday night I'll be talking about what to do about it in our energy challenge. Ultimately, I think it's important to leave your listeners with a sense of optimism. You know, this is actually a solvable problem. We can rebuild our entire energy infrastructure for actually a relatively low cost, something like what we're paying to fight the Iraq war. It's expensive.
A low cost, especially compared to the consequences if we don't do it.
I think that's right. So when I'm optimistic, I think, you know, compared to other things we've done in our history, this is actually not that big a deal. And therefore, when we wake up, we'll actually be able to solve this. And businesses are beginning to realize that this is actually going to happen. And they're beginning to realize they can make money doing it. And that's a good thing. When I get pessimistic is when I worry that by the time we wake up, let's hope it's not too late.
Daniel Schrag, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.